Welcome to the Exposing Mold podcast. My name is Keely Severson, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Eric Johnson and Alicia Swamy. Today, we are interviewing Michael Schrantz. He is in the environmental assessment industry.
This podcast is brought to you by Michael Rubino, the Mold Medic, and All American Restoration, the first and only mold remediation company in the country specializing in remediating mold for people with underlying health conditions or mold sensitivities. They've quickly become the most recommended remediation company from doctors and mold inspectors nationwide. Check out our show notes to pick up your copy of Michael Rubino's book, The Mold Medic, an expert guide on mold remediation, or visit allamericanrestoration.com to get your home assessed and get your health back on track today. This podcast is brought to you by My MycoLab. How are you feeling today? Are you tired, run down, sore, achy, and foggy? Have you been dealing with a chronic issue that you can't seem to shake? Been to doctor after doctor? Had lots of tests, tried many medications, vitamins, and supplements, and still feel awful? You, like many others, could be suffering from mycotoxin poisoning. Mycotoxins are called the great masqueraders of the 21st century because they present as so many different diseases and are often misdiagnosed by many clinicians who treat the symptoms rather than the cause. We have good news. There is hope. Visit mymycolab.com. That's mymycolab.com and order your test kit today. Let's rule out mycotoxins and help you on the road to better health. My MycoLab, making a difference by knowing the difference.
Michael, how many years have you been in the environmental assessment industry?
Going back to 1996, I think this would be year 25 I'm working on now.
Okay, so in the last 25 years, what I'm interested in hearing from you is, how have you seen the industry evolve and change?
Definitely more of a focus on lower dose exposures to various contaminants. The term chronic illness has risen in our industry more. You know, back in the 80s, 90s, and even you might even argue early 2000s, exposure was just kind of more of a formality. It was like someone had a water leak. We're thinking about mold, for example, and you just remediated and you did some testing to document it. And that was it. You just stopped talking about it. If you had a headache or some issues, you take some Tylenol and stop your complaining. And that was it. But there's been a sharp, for me personally, since, and I know it was going on before this, but for me, I really started seeing this focus on these lower dose concentrations, the types of concentrations that might be dismissed by your average industry in 2010. So it's been incredible. I exclusively now work with people who have some form of chronic illness or low dose environmental concern versus going out and doing testing for insurance claims and things of that nature.
When you say back in the day, people used to just be able to take some Tylenol for their headache, do you think that people have become less tolerant to Tylenol, or is there something in the illness community that's changing? Why are more people sick from mold now?
Oh gosh, it's a great question. Talking a little bit from my own personal experiences, I would argue mold's always had the same threat of concern. We could go back to Leviticus if we needed to, but I think one of the things that have probably not helped is the amount of stress in our life. I mean, somebody living in a moldy basement in 1950 stands to reason to have just the amount of negative health effects as somebody in a moldy basement today. But I think we're getting more awareness to the types of things that can cause exposure versus just ignoring them or writing them off as we don't really know, but you can take this pill or this thing and just kind of mask it and it'll go away and just kind of fight through it. And I think bringing awareness has really made people stop and go, you know what, maybe it's not something so broad strokey. Maybe it is something more specific. And it doesn't surprise me that way more people are aware of their health. I do think it's complicated because, as you guys well know, even during COVID, look at the sheer numbers of people that have been reporting high increases in anxiety. You couple all those things, take a look at that cytokine activity in your body, and all of a sudden you go, gosh, you know what? Maybe mold is an important piece here, and we have to take a look at the bigger picture. And mold certainly is a surrogate for a lot of people's exposures and health concerns.
If we're going to go back to Leviticus, do you find it strange that that Bible chapter doesn't actually reference black mold?
No, I don't think we're prejudiced. I think the mold can be a concern, whether it's white, green, red, or black. I think the concern is more holistic for a lot of folks. There's different concerns, as you well know, to mold exposures. You know, mycotoxins, inflammatory response to the mold itself. When we think about cytokine activity, I know you guys are familiar with this and that sort of thing. And we all know that the types of mold that can create that inflammation, that can create those mycotoxins, comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors.
Do you think there are any shortcomings in the industry?
Oh gosh, how much time do we have? I'm not sure. You might maybe rephrase the question, but I would humor you and say to you, one of the shortcomings is probably just not having enough people out there, enough professionals who can assess home or understand people. This obviously resonates with the industry I work in, who they can't really connect with the patient, or you might say the client, who has an environmental concern of exposure. They just kind of dismiss it, or they rule out that there's not an issue when maybe there is. This is a classic example of somebody thinks there is an issue, somebody goes out and tests the home, says there's not an issue, and then everyone's arguing with each other, including the clinician, who says you're still being exposed, and we're in this real circle of dilemma and conflict. And I think that's a real big shortcoming. We need to get that fixed.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm referencing in terms of assessment. Are there any shortcomings in actually finding what it is that people are complaining of? Or do you think that the testing and assessment is so thorough that it would find everything that somebody is complaining of?
No, I would argue I don't think we could ever do that, at least not in our generation, to be able to find everything. I agree. It's more the opposite. It's more, the focus is probably more on not knowing how far to go, not even thinking to go far enough, or thinking that you have gone enough. The classic example that we're hovering around, perhaps, of a 5-minute spore trap sample, maybe in certain applications can pick up an exposure, but what if it's a lower concentration or it doesn't detect something that just can't be picked up with a spore trap? And there's hundreds of examples we could get into, but that's missed, and then that's written off as there's no issue. So I think it is complicated, because I think our industry still needs to learn a lot about the limitations of testing, how a particular type of an assessment, whether it's just visual using real-time equipment or sampling, can help answer that person's question, and where to draw a reasonable line. I think we also are starting to see, speaking of which, just a hint of some companies out there that I think are a little bit extreme. And now we're seeing people that are coming out with limbic system issues and other debilitating things that get into the topics of like your parasympathetic, sympathetic, your flight or fight response, and that sort of thing. So I think in my personal opinion, a vast majority of the focus should be on people being more educated, but we have to be careful, I think, to balance it, because I think we're all fragile. Take a look at the amount of anxiety, all the things that have been occurring in more recent years. I think we need to be more responsible than coming out with black and white statements when we don't necessarily have the proof to back it up.
Do you think that people's response to their environment is tied to their stress? I'm just curious, when you say like a stress issue or anxiety, I'm not really sure what you mean by that.
Oh no, that exposure is complicated, right? I mean, if you are healthy, if you're taking care of yourself, but you have a genetic susceptibility, your response in a given environment might be less than if you carried a stress burden, you lost your job, you're going through a divorce, there's other confounding issues, and that same person in that same environment, but with those stresses, might react more severely. That's the only thing I'm mentioning. It's not to dismiss that exposure to mold itself is not a concern. It's just that it's complicated. This goes back to the previous question you're asking about, what am I seeing? What's my opinion?
Mm-hmm. Do you think people's response to mold illness is based on genetic susceptibility?
Hard to say. Don't play doctor, so I don't know. But I know that, of course, a lot of the research out there looks at the genetic susceptibility, the inability, the classic example, the inability of a person to detox or handle what would otherwise be a low dose exposure, or maybe even a normal exposure. That's hard. I don't think we really know, but they're susceptible. Seems like there's a lot of evidence of that, a lot of documentation of that, but don't really know. It's complicated. Sometimes you wonder if their inflammation is because of that or other issues. So a lot of times I end up working with clinicians and asking them, what's the focus? What are we looking at to see if I might be able to tailor an approach with that particular client so that we're maximizing their time and minimizing how much money they're spending?
Do you ever encounter people who say that they can just walk in a room and feel that there is mold or mold toxins present that they're reacting to?
Absolutely.
Do you ever have people complain of that even after an entire remediation has been completed?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's been jobs that I'm aware of, jobs I've been involved with, where after the fact, the person still is experiencing symptoms or feeling sensations. And yeah, that can be challenging, frustrating at times, not knowing why that's occurring.
Do you think that there could be residual contamination that remediation isn't removing? Or at that point, do you just start thinking it's something else bothering the patient?
No, your question is it's a possibility. I think all of those are open to possibility. Could there still be some stuff that wasn't remediated or otherwise removed effectively? Or could there be some other issue? Did we forget to ask whether or not they're working at a moldy office or something like that? Or is there something else in the building not related to the mold that's causing this as well? It's a tough question, but it does pop up often.
Do you ever come across Stachybotrys's evil twin, Stachybotrys chlorohalonata?
Not by any testing. I wouldn't know if that's what we were looking at or not.
Thank you. Thank you for answering the questions. I'm going to pass the mic to Eric and Alicia.
Absolutely.
So how did you get involved back in the 1990s, back in 1996?
For me, it was working for a family-owned air conditioning company. I was involved with helping design air conditioning systems, going out and verifying their installation would work, that sort of thing. Inherently, that I was involved with mechanical ventilation and how a home breathes, how air moves. So I was kind of learning about the fundamentals before I ever realized I was going to be doing this line of work. That led, while I was going through college in the early 2000s, to actually doing assessments. You might imagine an air conditioning company might get a call from time to time for condensate leaks and other issues not related to that. So I grew an interest. The ability to go out to a person's home and answer questions. Why is it that this material is occurring at our ceiling? What is that stuff? Or how do we fix this issue when other companies have it? And I grew an affinity to it. I love doing that type of work where we can go out and answer questions. So it was very broad stroking. It wasn't just specific to mold or bacteria or anything of that nature, but all of it. And I loved it so much that I certainly got my certifications and all of that good stuff and decided in 2007 of September, I believe, to start my own company that did indoor air quality assessments.
Did you make contact with the mold community back in the 1990s?
If by mold community, you mean, did people call me up who had mold problems? Yeah, I mean, that were happening, but I wasn't really, there's camps out there that I know you're very familiar with. And I wasn't even familiar with those at that time. In fact, I think the only big name that I knew, other than a few environmental colleagues, were people like King Tae Lin with Micometrics, that sort of thing. But no, I kind of just naturally migrated to where the demand took me.
So not like the mold community, Dr. Marinkovic in Redwood City, you know,
no.
Professor or Dr. Campbell.
And I know of the latter name. I'm not even familiar, I believe, with the former name.
Dr. Gary Ordog.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I'm bad with names, Eric, so that doesn't help much here. But I nothing significant. How about that?
I guess I was fortunate being up in a small town high in the Sierras when this mold paradigm really started to emerge. Because when people started pointing at it, there was no difference in their stress levels. These were just teachers, athletes, plain normal folks. Nothing had changed in their life whatsoever. But all of a sudden, they started dropping like flies from mold.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that this is the issue, is trying to figure out what is normal, what isn't normal, and where, as an environmental assessor, where are we falling short, if anything, to not detect something when there's a false negative. And like we mentioned earlier with Keeley, that's a major shortcoming, I think, in our industry.
Yeah, back in the 1970s, when the sick building syndrome was first collated, it was Legionnaires' disease and chemicals, no mold. Mold didn't even begin to hit the radar until the mid-1980s.
Now, printer toner was our focus, and lack of ventilation, and like you said, Legionnaires' disease and all that stuff. That's right. Very broad stroking.
Yeah, the copy machines, the printer toner.
Yeah, yep.
That was a major one.
Very, very familiar with the sick building syndrome stuff. That's kind of what I was dabbling in back in the HVAC days.
So in the 1980s, when people really started complaining about mold, and Dr. William Croft did his groundbreaking paper on trichothecene mycotoxins, which is, you know, this poster that I've got behind me. This was the first time toxic mold, the black mold Stachybotrys, really began to encroach into the media. And even then, it was so obscure that nothing was really known about it until Ruth Etzel brought it to public awareness with the 1994 Cleveland infant death incident.
Right. Yep. Familiar with that article. Yep.
Yeah, the indoor air quality credentials at that time were all towards chemicals.
Yeah, industrial hygienists, bacteria, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but no mold whatsoever. So it seemed that when the mold came into existence as a discrete entity, nobody wanted it. In fact, the indoor air quality profession didn't want to touch it. They felt this was into the realm of the infectious disease specialists.
Yeah, perhaps. I guess I was fortunate to avoid some of that kind of conflict and some of those issues. Of course, we have a whole other sort of conflict and issues today, so I didn't miss out on too much. But I mean, mold, although it can be considered to be a four-letter word to people, is, if nothing else, it can be a great surrogate to test for water-damaged buildings and whether it's directly because of the mold or there's something in addition to even the off-gassing of chemicals due to that water leak. Mold's been a great tool, and I wouldn't be shocked if you told me that insurance companies don't want to deal with it. Building owners don't want to deal with it, but I think that's more obvious, the amount of money that they would run into in fixing their problems, that sort of thing. But yeah, mold has been really at the core of a lot of our assessments when that sort of complaint comes up. I'm surprised that it was avoided for so long, if anything, based off of what you're sharing with me.
Yeah, if people really want to understand the history of the timeline of the emergence of the mold phenomenon, they can look at the insurance industry. Because if this had been known back in the 1980s, of course, they would have had exclusions for everything. And they didn't. In fact, none of these exclusions started to emerge until after the insurance company became aware of the Melinda Ballard incident in 1999.
Is that the Texas one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember warning doctors at the time, watch your mail because you're going to get some really interesting letters from your insurance company with disclaimers for anything related to water damage.
Yeah,
and they were shocked when this started arriving.
Yeah, yeah. And you had a couple of really well-known names. Dr. Gray, who I think was heavily involved in that one, and kind of wish that those names and faces were able to represent the mold industry perhaps back in the 70s and 80s when you were talking about that. That would have been hopefully helpful. But we evolve as a species. We learn.
Yeah, Aaron Brockovich was a big name back in 1999 when she got sick from mold and it wiped out her settlement. The fortune that she made from her movie was all used up fighting her own mold issues. And we hoped Aaron Brockovich would become a prominent mold spokesman, but she kind of took off and did other things.
Yeah.
Still, the fact that she could get no help or understanding back in the late 1990s, you know, tells us just how unfamiliar the medical profession was with it.
Yeah, I think it was a wake-up call. It's a shame, right? We're supposed to know our history and learn from it. And I don't think, you know, we know that mold's been around for a long time, but we're hopeful. I mean, there seems like there's enough momentum now, even if you're in different camps, the term, you know, different sort of camps, different clinicians that believe in different aspects of exposure or treatment. There's so much of it now. Whether or not we holistically agree with everything or not with each individual one, that is kind of hard to ignore. But rewind the clock back into the 90s, the 80s, and the 70s, I don't think there was really any, there weren't enough people screaming from the hilltop to get people's attention. And a lone wolf like Eric Johnson in Incline Village is sometimes not just enough. You know, you needed more people. And so I'm hopeful that we can use this momentum of professionals and clinicians to bring awareness. It's just my hope and goal that we do it responsibly. Because like I said, on one end, there's not enough information. That to me is the vast majority. But I start to see some people that I think just they're celebrity docs or they want to sell something and they scare the crap out of the community and that can be an issue. So I deal with that far less than I deal with the inspector that normally says, I took one spore trap sample in your house, didn't detect anything, you're fine. And the patient continues to be sick, though. So that's unfortunately my reality.
Yeah, even though I may be just one person, I represent a very large phenomenon.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
As a prototype for a new syndrome, essentially, I'm a representative for that syndrome.
Right.
And that gives me the ability to speak for it.
Yeah, no doubt. And we need more people like you.
So my goal is to get researchers to look back at the history and find out when this phenomenon emerged, because I believe that mold changed its properties back in the 1980s and became noticeably more pathogenic, because what's going on now could not previously been missed.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a great hypothesis of an idea, and I couldn't rule that out. It would be interesting to see where that could go.
So Dr. Marinkovich, down at Stanford, mm-hmm. he was the main guy on the West Coast back in the 1990s. Do you remember him, Dr. Mold?
No. I unfortunately, that probably, if that was his prime time, I was a little too young then.
Yeah, he made quite a name for himself battling with Stanford.
Oh.
The name Dr. Mold was actually a term of scorn, because Stanford was mocking him for his focus on what was merely an allergy.
Oh, I see. Yes.
And he was a real pioneer, and he did a lot of amazing work. He wrote some abstracts about serum sickness and how he believed that circulating complexes kind of combined in such a way to create this new kind of response, a new kind of like allergy that wasn't previously known in the past. So I'm going to Stanford. I make regular trips down to Stanford. I'm trying to get them to recognize his work, because frankly, I think he deserves a plaque for being a true mold pioneer.
He looked beyond the face value of a typical allergen and was looking for other relationships and how our bodies were responding, is what it sounds like. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he passed away and his work kind of got glossed over. And now many people are thinking that some of the more recent doctors are the mold pioneers, when they haven't even heard of Dr. Marinkovich.
Yeah.
So Dr. Shoemaker and I were working together for a long time on trying to get mold into the mainstream. And then lately, he's taken a bit of a turn and gone into actinomycetes. In fact, his change of focus was so dramatic that he actually expressed regret that he titled his books Mold Warriors and Surviving Mold. Hmm. And this doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because so far the evidence for mold is still holding up. I mean, even if actinomycetes and endotoxins are a major player in sick building syndrome, I mean, you wouldn't go so far as to say, well, I was wrong and that was a mistake. Have you looked into actinomycetes?
Personally, yes. Obviously, being familiar, one of the great things about myself is I get to sit in a lot of camps, because I don't have to play politics or get into the certain issues that would maybe prevent somebody from being in one camp versus the other. This idea of believing in exposure and what it's all about, or how to fix it, how to treat it, what to be concerned about. And so, yeah, I'm naturally familiar with the actinos conversation. I'll try to take this topic lightly and respectfully. I have, you know, like you said, actinos have been around, you could argue, longer than mold has, depending on if you want, you know, what debate of evolution you want to get into. And we know that actinos have, I mean, even in the bioaerosols book of 1999 is discussed. It's not like it's some new thing. Not really sure. I wasn't there when he was, it sounds like Dr. Shoemaker and some of his public releases or statements or comments have suggested that mold's not a concern. I don't live with Shoemaker, so I don't know where he's at with all of that. But I would argue that we would be concerned about both. Is it possible that a person listening right now may have more, the term would be right, gene expression with an actino than mold? Yeah, possible. I'm not a doctor. But I go back to the environmental piece of how can we find that source? In other words, if there's been a damp event, water damage event, something, and it's created some sort of microbial growth, what is the most practical way to holistically, keyword there, identify the source and holistically be able to remove it all? And fortunately for my particular industry, I don't need to necessarily always sample for both or one or the other. I can take a look at the situation, take a look at what the doctor or the clinician is saying there's an exposure issue, and focus on that. In fact, my understanding, speaking of actinos coming out of Dr. Shoemaker's camp, is that there's a lot of interest right now in the human habitat form of the actinos that are common and commensal on our skin, that sort of thing. And there's somehow being some response to certain patients, not everybody, but that they're responding to that exposure themselves. And of course, the million-dollar question is why, what makes that unique? But in so much that that's the case, that doesn't take away the mold concern for me. I don't think the mold concern will ever really go away, at least in the near future, if nothing else. because many of the professionals like myself that deal in this industry have been using mold as their surrogate for decades. And we understand their physiology much better. We understand we have a better idea of what the term normal fungal ecology means than we would normal bacterial ecology. So there's a sharp learning curve with the actinos, and I don't claim to be an expert. I've been treading very lightly and trying to be responsible with the patients and the clients when that comes up. But mold's still, gosh, Eric, what? When we're dealing with water damage building, in my particular experience, 90, 95%, if not more, of our conversations.
Well, I used to work in construction. I was out there all winter long shoveling snow off houses while we were out there framing. And basically, we just went on with life. Everything got soaking wet. And years ago, this wasn't a problem. It was just amazing how within the last 25 years, now it's a major problem. And there are people are scared to death of any water leak. Houses always leaked.
Right.
And this idea that this emerged as a result of the oil embargo of the 1970s with tighter buildings, with more water leaks, kind of a little opposite concept there. It's like we're building better and building worse at the same time.
Yeah, which I think is what was happening. It depends on what we mean by better and what we mean by worse.
I think houses have always been pretty much the same. The construction techniques haven't really changed all that much. And I don't think our construction workers suddenly started sabotaging us.
No, but I think if we're being fair to that particular topic, what you could say, this doesn't rule out things completely, but we need to be more objective, is that when houses were built tighter, the margin of error decreased for mistakes. For example, the dew point and condensation building up in walls, lack of homes being able to breathe, tighter buildings, not tighter by water leak, but by air standards, being tested with blower door testing, showing that a house is tighter, contaminant levels were building up. This is nothing secret. This is not bar napkin theory. This is well documented. But there were other things, right? The building materials that they were using were more conducive for microbial growth. So instead of real plywood, we were using oriented strand board and the glues and the adhesives and all that plays too. That doesn't mean that within that conversation that there can't be some new strain of mold that has evolved and made worse like a virus. That doesn't mean that that excludes that, but we can't exclude the fact that, I mean, my background's in building
absolutely.
Science.
Absolutely. That oriented strand board, that's horrible stuff.
Right.
I mean,
we're using that
mold
left and right. So,
but unfortunately, in my opinion, people focused on these materials as being the source of the problem when I saw this phenomenon emerging before these materials were even introduced.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I hear you.
So my concern is what changed? And is it in the person? Is it our susceptibility? Is it stress? Is it more chemicals? Or did the mold really do something interesting?
Is there an E, all of the above?
Yeah, I believe that to a certain extent, you sheetrock. I mean, they started incorporating toxic mold directly into the processing of the paper backing. So all you needed to do is apply a little water and sheetrock is a disaster waiting to happen.
Walking, talking petri dish.
Yeah. But when I got sick with mold, this was in old buildings from the 1800s, and it was prior to these materials. Mm-hmm. And we had very tight buildings back then. And there was plenty of opportunities for this type of thing to emerge. And because I was aware of it, I started looking around for other people like me. And I didn't see this correlation to what was going on with the new materials. Rather, I saw the way old colonies exposed to new water started acting up.
Yeah. Being laying dormant in a new moisture source is what you're saying comes into play and it recolonizes or starts to germinate again or whatever the mechanism was.
Well, considering the way many different buildings that had been unchanged for many, many years, decades prior to the original chronic fatigue syndrome outbreak, I could tell that nothing had really changed. No introduction of new chemicals, no alteration in the styles of the buildings. Everything had stayed pretty much the same. But the colonies that were fed fresh water were the ones that acted up. There were mold colonies in these buildings which stayed exactly the same and did not affect people. So my conclusion was that there was probably something that came in on the wind, something in the atmosphere. So that's kind of been my little hobby.
I hear you. Yeah, it's complicated. I think that's where we can find consensus here is, you know, I joked with Truth about could it be E, all of the above. I think the truth is it's probably a combination of a lot of these things. It's, of course, the issue of trying to weigh it. Okay, was this 10%? Was this 90%? You know, and is there any sort of synergistic effect of all of it? Now add into the equation, and it was already included, but your genetic susceptibility. You're in the same house as somebody else with different genetics, and they're quote unquote fine. You're not. Why? And let's assume let's assume there's perfect exposure too. In other words, that you've had the same exact exposure as the other one, which you and I both know is impossible. But let's just say, for the sake of the argument, why is that? House didn't change. The same house. Mold didn't change. You had the same exposure. So it's. I would agree. And this goes, by the way, Eric, into touching on some certain. I'll just use the term like celebrity peoples, docs, bloggers, who either ignorantly, knowingly, or unknowingly make claims without considering the bigger picture for whatever the reason is. It might be just something innocent, like there's a passion, or it might be greed or whatever it is. But I think indoor air quality is complicated. I think we used to get away with it more. Part of that was just that I think we had, it's possible that mold bacteria, just like viruses, have evolved. I don't think there's any argument. We know that there's strains of molds and all of these things. It's well documented. But I think that it's a soup of issues. And that's what my truth to you is that as soon as like the last year for me, I've been woke up, you might say. What's the term now? Is it woke to this idea of, you know what? Yeah, certainly there's a mold exposure. Let's address it. Certainly there's a leak. Let's address it. Certainly let's take a look at this home. Is there a way to improve the indoor air quality? This thing is built like a sealed container. I mean, somebody cooks popcorn in their house, they're going to be smelling it for the next 2 weeks, kind of a thing. But could there be other things at hand? Could there be other stresses? And going through a little bit of my own personal experience myself, I know the power of our brains and our minds and how it doesn't help the matter. And so it's complicated when somebody shows up, consult with me, and I, you know, guide them through their situation, try to educate and provide them with direction. I often find it's not just as easy as some simple mold problem in a basement. I usually find it's that needs to be addressed, but they also need to look at these other things. These other things can be like they're dealing with SIBO, or they're dealing with a limbic system issue. Their anxiety is high and they're in the freeze mode the entire time. I see a lot of that. Now, is that because I'm naturally attracting people like that? Me in the past year, it's possible, but it's amazing how complicated our environments of why weren't we dealing with that before? Well, I don't know. Were we as stressed out before? Were our buildings as tight before? Did the mold evolve since then? Is it more toxic today than it was yesterday? These are all great questions that I don't have hard answers for. I can only speculate and form hypotheses.
Well, thanks to the internet, with all this exchange of information, we've got a great opportunity here to watch this thing unfold. And I think outside of the first sighting of mold, I think people, first of all, need to start at the beginning by going back to the first time this was reported, to try to get a sense of the mindset, what the observations were of the scientists, the doctors who first, you know, saw fit to put this into the literature. And then beyond that, to examine the stories of all the doctors who've gotten sick in the last 10 years. And over again, you see the same story that all these doctors, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them now, they had no awareness of toxic mold whatsoever. In most cases, they were unable to diagnose themselves. They couldn't figure it out. To me, that is absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
That's a pretty scary indication of just how unfamiliar this phenomenon is.
Yeah. Or the plumber that has bad plumbing. I mean, they're working with these clinicians are working with the very people that we're talking about, and they were suffering too, but not even realizing it. I see that more often than I'd like.
Yeah. The plumbers and contractors were the first people I asked, because back in the 1980s, doctors really didn't know anything about this. And I thought, who can give me some good clues about this? I thought, well, the people who are going out to clean up the flood damage, the plumbers that are going out to fix that leak, they're going to be coming face to face with this stuff.
Yeah, first responders.
Stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, these will be the people to ask.
Absolutely.
To my surprise, initially, they said they had never seen any kind of illness like this. I mean, they've claimed that they've been cleaning up flooded buildings their entire career and never seen anybody sick from mold. And then about 1985, I started hearing now and then, oh yeah, there was this one guy. And it just started growing from there. And more people, more plumbers, just one time come face to face with the colony of black mold, drop in their tracks, have some kind of strange flu-like illness. And they couldn't find any doctors who would even believe them.
Still is a challenge today with doctors trying to understand or be willing to understand someone's exposure versus just writing you a prescription, kind of like the Tylenol analogy earlier. So yeah, it's still tricky. I don't think we've got to the finish line yet.
So in terms of examining this, I want to make sure that, yeah, people use the most sophisticated testing and technology available. At the same time, I'd like them to examine the history for clues that perhaps things weren't always this way.
Agreed. Your history, I think you're referring to, is more substantial, going back to why is this even a talking point, or what's a good way to narrate that talking point. And history is something we definitely talk about, not going that far back, of course, but even understanding what's going on with the home. I think that it would be nice if there was more education. Finding the time, finding the reliable sources, finding consensus has always been, I think, a challenge. People can publish anything nowadays. It doesn't necessarily mean it's vetted by the world. And bringing that to the table to make people aware, make the community more aware that I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill here, but this is a serious concern. I mean, water damaged buildings are an issue, and you're just keep stacking other things in your life. And if you have a moldy basement, I use that as a classic example. I don't think that's something that you should leave alone, especially if there's even the slightest concern or indication of exposure going on.
Well, back in the 1980s, one thing we knew is mold didn't do this by itself. It wasn't normal for this to happen. And even those people who were concerned about sick buildings and who came face to face with the mold, typically they could endure it. They could go home on weekends, or teachers in particular, they'd take a summer off, they'd get considerably better, and they would lose ground during the school year. But for the most part, they tended to recover. And then this poster behind me started to note a peculiar phenomenon where people did not recover. They would go into these buildings and something would switch, like a trigger had kicked them over into a state of inability to recover.
Right.
And they looked for patterns. And the first one was a toxic black mold, Stachybotrys. That was part of it. And the second was viral reactivation. That if you reached a certain point where you would seroconvert with a viral infection, that the combination of the two was required to result in the chronic form of the condition. So what we need to do, in my opinion, is get mold researchers to work with virologists, doctors who are working with the reactivated viruses, put the clues together and see how the combination of the two is more than the sum of its parts.
Makes sense. There's the synergy part. Yeah.
We noted that it wasn't just Epstein-Barr virus, though. That was the most common because nearly everybody has EBV. But commonly, the next in line was probably cytomegalovirus, and then a new one, human herpes virus 6. And it didn't seem to matter which virus it was. If you reached a certain level of viral activation, that was the cutoff point. So you talk about clusters of illness and susceptibility, where people all in a sick building, they seem to be slightly different. Well, rather than stress levels, what I was seeing was which particular pathogens they had. Whatever fungal or bacterial or viral infections, it was the corresponding cytokine cascade from the severity of whatever reactive illness they had, which tended to drive them into the chronic condition more so than any other factor.
Interesting.
Even when people have the Epstein-Barr virus, doctors should still look for something else at the same time. We saw it with parvo too.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that.
So this poster, this is the greatest thing because it's a compendium of the earliest sightings of mold illness. And most of these are contained in the 1994 Saratoga Springs Proceedings Manual. This was edited by Eckhard Johanning and Dr. Qin Yang.
Yeah.
And it's fabulous because it is really the best historical document of when mold illness really, you know, intersected with the indoor air quality profession and the medical profession at the same time. And there's two chapters in this book that ask specifically if one particular mold was connected with the new chronic fatigue syndrome, the Holmes 1980 chronic fatigue syndrome. And they pose the question in the book, the entire chapter by Pierre Auger dedicated to this proposition, is Stachybotrys, the dreaded black mold, connected to chronic fatigue syndrome? And since I was in that building and I was a prototype for the syndrome, I can answer that unequivocally. Absolutely, it was.
Stachy's a surrogate, a major indicator mold that we use, a tertiary type mold that shows up to water-damaged buildings that have been prolonged exposures, high saturation, a very reliable mold from the investigative side. I end up looking at Stachy and Ketonium quite a bit as good indicators for longer types of exposures, still do today.
Ah, the trichothecene producers.
Well, and that's the other thing too, is what are we focusing on? Are we focusing on the mycotoxins, or are we testing? A lot of times my particular experience is with the qPCR analysis and looking for the fungal fragments and the whole history behind that. But yeah, looking at those molds as, again, surrogates, because we know that there's more than just 36 molds that are on an ERMI panel if we go to that particular type of test, and others at species of Aspergillus and Penicillium that have long been useful tools for professionals like myself to indicate that there is an exposure, types of exposures that sometimes are missed with your traditional four-trap sampling, going back to that. And I don't want to bash on four-trap sampling. I've taken tens of thousands of those samples. I think there's a time and a place for that. But with a lot of the folks that we're dealing with and just what we've learned from our own personal experiences, is a lot seems to be missed. And that kind of resonates with your point about sometimes beyond any sort of evolution of a species and how it might be more toxic than it is today, what about just flat out missing it? Never mind.
Yeah, feel free to bash. Absolutely. Because four-trap sampling is absolutely what missed Stachybotrys and caused all this confusion.
Oh, in your particular case?
Yeah, if they had known to do tape sampling at the in the original chronic fatigue syndrome cluster, they might have come up with some better data. But as it was, they just did some spore traps, didn't find anything, and essentially gave up on the investigation at that point. We found the Stachybotrys later.
Yeah, not
but the reason we brought up Stachybotrys chlorohalonata, the evil twin, is because it does the most amazing, devious thing. Stachybotrys charterum has a lot of neuroinflammatory compounds that give a lot of warning to its presence. People will have headaches, inflammation, rashes, the dreaded fatigue. The chlorohalonata produces it's more weighted to the atrenones, the immunosuppressive compounds, without the neuroinflammatory ones. So what we find is there's a possibility that where we thought Stachybotrys was present, but not necessarily pathogenic, it was the evil twin that was purely suppressing immune function, leaving people open to these viral infections without all the warning signs that would otherwise tell them to get out.
Interesting. And that's not, I wonder how easy, or if that's even on a qPCR. I mean, I know it's not on the panels to be looked at. And I don't know that that's a common species that can be separated or identified on an auger plate, that sort of thing. It'd be interesting in learning more about that.
Yeah, it's indistinguishable by sight. You can only tell the difference by PCR testing.
Interesting. So they don't have a commercially available, but you could technically test for it using qPCR is what you're saying.
Yes. Of course, in order to know, you would have to, you know, be aware of this and look for it. And Dr. Chin Yang brought this out at the 2019 Fort Lauderdale Mold Congress, that they don't know about this. And maybe many of the inexplicable chronic illnesses might be due to the evil twin because they missed the signs that something really pathogenic was going on.
That's possible. Hard to say, right? Especially from my chair.
Yeah. So anyway, this is a fascinating topic, and all we can do is try to get researchers to look into it.
There's no argument there. I think that diving into it and getting the resources to do that and actually execute the work with as much stuff that is out there, nice to find consensus and ideas of, oh, wow, we never realized that. We've done that a few times with the evolution, the commercialization of qPCR testing. It's gone through its rodeo of what people know, what people don't know, what people like, dislike about it. But it takes people like yourself and others that are out there that aren't willing to give up and bring this to my attention. Like, for example, this particular species of Stachya, I had no idea about its presence and how that may or may not eventually change the game and how we add that, if I could use a term, to assess a home and try to help rule that in and out and see if there's commonality. Oh my goodness, look at this. Whenever these people are having some sort of symptomatic or cytokine activity, you name it, this mold keeps popping up. Why is that?
Well, thanks to being an original prototype for chronic fatigue syndrome, I've got strong links with the ME/CFS community. And so I've got their ear. I can talk to them. But as it stands right now, they're saying, well, the problem is you have no backup. You've got no doctors, no researchers working with you. So all I need is a little bit of scientific muscle backing me up, and I can get Stanford to listen to me.
It's almost like a smaller in-house study, taking a look at that and draw that attention. And then that might wake up Stanford, which I think is what your goal is.
Exactly.
Well, that's why we're here today, right? We're helping back up Eric's hypothesis here and also bring information to the table where if someone gets mold injured, the information is just scattered all over the net. I mean, we've all been mold injured here. Myself, Keely, Eric, and I, we're all very hypersensitive. So we're the low dose exposure group.
Yeah.
And nothing exists for us. Professionals tell us that we're crazy. Remediators downplay our situation. Not saying that's you. I'm just saying, just in general, people that we have encountered, you seem to get it because you understand low dose exposure can still irritate someone. But, you know, it was just so frustrating that none of this was housed in one place and nothing is really happening in terms of the research arm of it with, you know, Eric really pursuing this for so long and saying, hey, something's going on with Stachybotrys. It was connected to the original cohort of CFS. There's very interesting characteristics, according to the experts that have studied this mold. And also, what's going on with the mold? Why is it changing? Why is it that every person has a mold story now? And so it's like, we don't have these answers and we want to try to find these answers. And kind of like you said, we're more so, Eric has been asking, but I think we just need to be citizen scientists here and start our own little coalition and move forward with the research, because so many people are asking questions and more people are showing up asking questions and more people are getting sick and people are sick of being sick and finding no solutions that it's time, you know.
If you were able to get, using Eric's example of this particular species of Stachy, right? If you were to get any of the labs that offer this commercial sampling to add it as a 37th organism, which does not take an act of Congress per se. Once you get to that step, you could always look at doing that. It would be an idea. I did that with Streptomyces with Mycometrics. It's why it's on there right now after conversations with Dr. Kingtae Lin, was because bacteria, even back then, was, you know, hey, we don't want to charge people hundreds or thousands of dollars, because I'm sure people can resonate like yourself about that issue, is how much money is this all going to cost me? But for a nominal amount of money, I think it's, I don't know if it's changed, but $20, you can add on this organism and have it analyzed. And we started doing that because prior to that, we were in the same boat you guys were in. We had an idea, we had a hypothesis, but we didn't have 50 clinicians or the EPA backing us. It was just kind of like, and so to me, I see that's what my two cents. I think that that's where a good way to segue into it, because you start bringing that to people's attention, even if it's just listed as an option, you can start doing that. And then all of a sudden it's easy to add that on to clients where they resonate with this idea, this concern. Hey, we listened to your guys' episode and we understand that nothing's a guarantee, but you know, my story resonates really close to your guys' story and we'd love to add that on there. I mean, that to me is responsible and doesn't require a second mortgage for the people who are spending the money to do the testing.
Yeah. And, you know, we really appreciate just experts like you who are understanding these low dose exposures, but it's not the norm. And I guess my question to you is how do we make that the norm for, you know, mold testers, remediators across the board?
Yeah, I think there's all kinds of analogies, right? One bad apple can ruin a bunch and things of that nature. I think for me and my personal experience, it's to answer your question, it's getting a solid foundation of facts. You can have 99 good facts about mold and exposure. We can refer to the World Health Organization 2009 mold document and all these things that support this idea of exposures or the concern for mold, at least, and have one bad document in there. and everyone's going to focus on the one. And we've seen these things tumble over and over because of that. And so I think it's being able to speak truth. I think the answer is right in front of us. We just complicate it. Sometimes we get in our own way. If we can just be honest about what we know and what we don't know, that will naturally invite conversation and say, well, you know what, this is interesting. The people that don't want to get involved with low dose exposures, typically it's because they don't even understand what that means, or they don't want to deal with the liability of it. They're saying a job fails when the remediator wants it to pass, and there's conflict, and the next thing you know, they're getting a subpoena because they had a third party inspector come out that was paid $500 an hour to say, no, I would have passed this. And you just get into the weeds too quickly. We need groups of like-minded individuals, and a shameless plug here is like ICI, the International Society for Environmentally Acquired Illness, a nonprofit, has a huge reach of like-minded professionals. Not everybody agrees 100%, but since when is that the case? You guys don't agree 100%. And bring together this idea of, well, can we bring in research money? For example, that organization I just mentioned to you on Giving Tuesday just raised money for the environmental piece of ICI to take a look at what things we might be able to study, what's in most demand. They just got done. They're currently going through a mycotoxin urine research study right now. That was the previous Giving Tuesdays. Over $40,000 was raised. So I think it's getting together with people who aren't defensive, who can speak their truth about what they know and don't know. And then that will naturally build us for the awareness part, because I'm screaming from the hilltops like you. I deal with inspectors or remediation companies in other states, other countries, where I had a client the other day was in Greece, and we're working with a contractor who looks at mold way different than what we look at it, right? This is mold. Welcome to Greece. This is we're right by the ocean. What do you expect? And not saying, yeah, and I understand that, but that doesn't mean that's acceptable, and getting them to drop down. So continued education, just what we're doing, I think are the same issues that our forefathers ran into. It's a struggle. You guys are doing the grinding, the nose grinding work. You're in the weeds. I am too. But it's just bringing consensus, bringing people together, and then having the audience going, you know what? This isn't just Eric's voice. This is Eric's voice times 100,000, a million plus people. And you could argue even higher, that are just trying to bring awareness that we shouldn't be downplaying exposures. And there is a responsible way to assess and remediate and fix that exposure without giving the public the opinion that you need to live on Mars in a bubble, which we get from time to time, is that extreme, is because where does it end? And so the struggle is real. And it's been a pleasure being able to talk with you guys to kind of kick this stuff up, because I think it needs to be done more often.
Yeah, this organization you mentioned is perfectly poised to bring awareness to this issue, because most of them are former Shoemaker doctors, and nearly all of them have read his books, and they are fully aware of mold at ground zero for chronic fatigue syndrome, so that there's a connection between their paradigm and this famous syndrome. And, you know, doctors like Dr. Navial,
yeah,
Dr. Neil Nathan,
yep,
Lauren Tessier,
yep,
all these people are familiar enough with the connection between the syndrome and their paradigm that essentially all they have to do at this point is speak the words, and then Stanford and Nova and Harvard and the others that are wondering about it, they'll fall into line.
Yeah, there's that consensus we're talking about. And, you know, Eric, just my personal experience, I know that's all we can all base this off of, is I think there's a way to get more consensus from even some of the more polarized camps, or, you know, just because somebody says one thing doesn't mean we can't all get together and sing kumbaya. Jokes aside, I think we can. I think it's just about finding that common ground. And it's unfortunate, because if the goal here was perfection, I could tell you I've failed in life with things that I used to think, yeah, I see that. What's that? That goes back.
Yeah, this is my poster. This is essentially a little document that I made up to take to symposiums, to show that there was evidence that actually started the chronic fatigue syndrome. This is not in doubt. It's all documented. And there it is, Stachybotrys. So this is something we can unite on.
Yeah.
It's one nasty black toxic mold with its known properties can serve as a means to bring us all together, so that we can agree that at least there's one agent worth looking into.
Yeah.
And it's all revolves around a syndrome, which is a world famous syndrome with millions of people all debating about it.
Right.
And this is the incident that started it all.
Yeah.
If there's anything that can bring us all together, this is it.
To bring the history, the experience, and apparently a pretty cool poster that shows a picture from, was that 1986?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Goes back a minute.
The mystery illness.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right. You're speaking to the point of consensus and finding the core, the commonality that brings this awareness to people. I've been fortunate because a lot of the camps I do sit in, and I know this doesn't necessarily help those listening, but I am in these camps where this idea of low dose environmental exposure concerns is commonly talked about, that clinicians have a growing concern for lower doses where before they just didn't know. They don't know. They stayed in their lane. Their lane was clinical. Our lane's environmental. You stay in your lane, I'll stay in mine. And getting to know that, you know, I hear that and that's great, but we need to have a little bit of overlap in terms of understanding, not me playing doctor, but me understanding what are you even looking at? And from the clinical point of view is, well, what is out there? What does a test really tell us? These are clinicians that are coming out of a conventional model of exposure, testing blood and using as a physics or it's science diffusion. One sample here is the same if you sample over there. That's like the opposite of the environment we work in. You could have a mold problem in your master bedroom, but doesn't present itself in the living room, you know, and getting together and understanding how there is commonality, but where there's differences. And I've been, gosh, I guess the term that comes up right now is fortunate. I'm in that in the thick of it, but there are many people, unfortunately, out there that are not aware about these types of organizations or not even aware of this type of exposure where these types of conversations are occurring. So how do we get more people to join and become aware? Well, it's doing stuff like this. It's bringing that to their attention. Yeah, we think this is a real deal. We want to honor the exposure. We don't want to make less of it. That's been the issue, hasn't it? But we don't want it. We want to let those people know who are a little bit afraid to put dip their toes in the water that we're not trying to be extreme. We want to use sound, factual information, raise money. The industry is there for it. There's the demand. Giving Tuesday seen $40,000 raised for a urinalysis mycotoxin study. If that doesn't tell you that there's an interest, I don't know what does. It's not like we're raising money to go to some concert from some celebrity. This is nerd stuff. This is not the people that are raising the money are the people that are suffering. People like yourself who've been there. So yeah, I'm actually happy because I think that there's the ability to grow in these types of projects, to pose these types of questions, Eric. And I think it's a great thing to explore further, maybe offline.
Excellent. We'll get some good science.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Michael. If our listeners wanted to consult with you or get help from you, where can they find you?
Yeah, thank you for that. There's two things. If they're just looking for general education, background, topics on what is chronic illness or why it's important, tips on remediation, types of testing, they can go to IEP Radio, the letters IEP and then radioafterwards.com. And there's a wealth of information there, video cast, podcast references. You know, a lot of times people go, well, you say that, where'd you get that from? Where were you basing that off of? Well, I like that question. So that's why we added the references page. If they're wanting to consult with me, they can go to my website, Environmental Analytics, one big long word, environmentalanalytics.net. Go to the contact page and fill it out, and we'll try and help you.
Thank everyone for joining us today. It was a wonderful conversation with Michael Schrantz. He is an environmental indoor assessor, and he had some really interesting things to say today. Seems like Eric and Michael were able to connect on some common ground, so that's always great. And hopefully, we will be able to get some more research into Stachybotrys and CFS and go back to the original evidence and move forward from there so we can really make connections and figure out what the heck is going on with this mold, why it's making so many people sick. So please like, share, comment on our content. Also, check out our GoFundMe and Patreon pages to keep this podcast rolling. So again, please check us out, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.